For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
All right, so we're talking about the fall of the human race. The imagery there is just the common stock, I guess, of Western culture. But I really want us to think about this very carefully tonight and also next week. And I want to begin just by putting this before you, asking, what is this? What do you think? Who's got a thought? Anybody? It's art. Okay, that's a very general point. Can we... Jackson Pollock. Wow, we got an art critic in our midst. Absolutely true. Can we be more specific still? Nope. Okay, so we're going to return to this in just a little while. I wanted to get it up on the early end because there's a point to be made about this, and I don't want you to miss it. So there it is, Jackson Pollock, right there. Now, Moses, Genesis chapter 3, verse 1. Now the serpent was more crafty than any beast of the field which the Lord God had made. So without any introduction whatsoever, without any context, boom, the serpent shows up in the Garden of Eden after the creation of the earth and the heavens, after the special creation of humanity in God's image, male and female, that whole thing that we talked about a couple of weeks ago, the serpent shows up and introduces us then to chapter 3, which is all about the temptation and the fall of Adam and Eve and of the human race. It's really important that we get this part, though, that from the Bible's point of view and the assumption from the very beginning, not even of chapter 3, but also all the way back to Genesis chapter 1, verse 2, as we talked about this question of what did the creation narrative mean in its original context and to its original audience. Part of it was that that they understood formlessness and void to be the idea that there's something wrong, there's something broken about God's creation. The introduction of evil has already occurred before humanity gets on the scene. This angel, this incredibly powerful, incredibly majestic, beautiful, intelligent being, we're told in Ezekiel 28, took a turn inward and began to contemplate his own glory independent of God's. And he became conceited and rebelled. And that rebellion has divided our universe, and we live in a spiritually evil context. This is an important question when we think about the world that we live in. Is this the world at its normal? Is this kind of as it should be? It's just the way it is. Or is there something fundamental and pervasively wrong with the creation? Wrong with the human race? Something that is so broke that we do not have the capacity to fix it. That's an important question because that's our starting point. Are we just a little bit bent and can fix ourselves? Okay, that would be one perspective. More or less a humanistic one that says, as John F. Kennedy did so many years ago, that all of man's problems have been caused by man and can be solved by man. If we just add the right kind of social engineering and things like that, these things are going to go away. The Bible, on the other hand, says something very different, saying that there is something at the root of the human experience and of the human race and of human history and each of us as human beings that is not normal. And that, as it turns out, as we'll see, is actually really good news. Because if this is normal, that's really bad. If this is abnormal, it gives rise to the possibility that God in the mix could bring something beautiful out of it. And that is indeed, of course, the story of the Scriptures. But our starting point matters. This is not the world as God intends it or as God will leave it, but it is the starting point for the human experience that we live in a divided cosmos, that creation is in revolt against God, but that we ought not to worry about that in the long term. The reality is, and this is a very important statement, it says that the serpent was more crafty than any of beasts of the field, which, he says, the Lord God had made. What does that mean? That means that the serpent is a created being. He's not co-eternal with God. It's not like they have this eternal good and eternal bad that are in forever conflict with one another. Not so. Evil emerges out of God's creative order and is subject to his rule, to his sovereignty. And that's the starting point of the creation narrative. Now let's read on to the temptation. It says, he said to the woman, indeed, as God said, you shall not eat from any tree of the garden. And the woman said to the serpent, from the fruit of the tree of the garden we may freely eat, but from the fruit of the tree which is in the middle of the garden, God has said, you shall not eat from it or touch it, or you will die. The careful reader will realize that Eve is not exactly, she didn't exactly have the story right. God didn't say anything superstitious about touching the thing. The serpent said to the woman, look, here's what it is. You shall surely not die. And God knows that in the day that you eat from it, your eyes will be opened. You'll be like God, knowing good and evil. And when the woman saw that the tree was good for food and that it was a delight to the eyes and that the tree was desirable to make one wise, she took from its fruit and ate. And she gave also to her husband who was with her. And he ate. So what's going on? This tree, we talked about this a couple weeks ago, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. This is not some kind of a magic tree. It's not the point of the thing. It's not some kind of a taboo story that is common to many cultures. The point of this story is that God has set in the Garden of Eden the possibility of something unimaginable, namely, the possibility of using our freedom to defy our own creator. Indeed, if God makes human beings in his image, as personal beings, beings capable of relationship, beings capable of love, that requires, by definition, the capacity to choose. Automatons don't love. See the Stepford Wives movie sometime. It's the classic story and set in the modern context about this. We know, we sense within ourselves the need that to ground love, commitment, in freedom, that we're making a real choice to move toward another person. And that's the way God is. That's the way all personal beings are. And therefore, God set humanity in this garden with open access to him, in harmony with one another, but with the opportunity to go our own way. And so we are free to go to our own way. We are not, however, as we've said here many times, we are not free with respect to the consequences of that choice because we live in God's world and we are creatures, not creators. And so this is how this thing kind of unfolds. The heart of the matter, we want to talk about three things here. The first part of what is really wrong with mankind, what is really at the heart of what's wrong with human history, what's wrong with our society, what's wrong with every single one of us here tonight as individuals, really can be understood from the perspective of three dimensions of this interaction that God's enemy, Satan, has with Adam and Eve, and the temptation and the breaking ranks with this open relationship with God to move into this place of utter separation and alienation from him. There are three things. One, there is an assault against the character of God. Satan just puts it out this way. You will surely not die. God said in Genesis 2, he said, you can eat from this tree, you can do that, but from in the day that you eat from it, you shall surely die. What does that mean? Well, they had not really seen death. So that was a troubling thing. But the reality is, there are going to be consequences, dire consequences. And Satan is simply saying that God's got it wrong. God is lying to you. You should not trust his word. Why does God lie? Because it says your eyes will be open. You'll be like God. And what he's saying is that God is withholding something from you, something good, something powerful. And he's keeping this from you so that he can maintain his control over you. That's what it is. And so what do these things really add up to? The bottom line is that there is in the heart of God's rebels, whether they are spiritual beings like the angels who have fallen and who are now demons, or the whole lot of the human race who has joined them in this revolt, there is a shift from a simple trust and obedience relationship to God, to take God at his word and to obey that word. Two, now a place of suspicion. Is God lying to me? Is God calling me to do things not for my good, but for the sake of his control over me? That is the first thing that animates the heart of fallen people. It's there in your life too. We think in terms of the conflict between my self-interest versus the will of God. There is deep within the heart of every person, I sense it in myself, a certain kind of a foot dragging, a reluctance, I'm going to have to give this a real long look kind of thing when I understand the call of God on my life to set aside the interests of self for the sake of another person. I think to myself, okay, that's the will of God, but what about me? What about me? Many of us in our home churches are asking this question. We're saying, well, what's in it for me? I'll get involved if there's reward in this for me. And really, what are we saying? We're saying, I will move forward with the God thing. I'll trust him only to the extent that it is clear that it preserves my self-interest. That ultimately I'm living on my terms. Because why? Because deep down inside there is a suspicion that the things that God is calling me to are not ultimately the very best things for me. And many of us are stuck right on that point. Right on that point. So theologically, we understand, you know, the earth is the Lord's and everything within it. And we understand theologically that we are a creature made in the image of a creator. And that we are called on by that creator to live for him. We get that. But when it comes down to what motivates our decision making, how we assess the cost-benefit analysis of moving forward with God, there is a suspicion that often runs very deep in there. It comes out in various ways. It comes out in our marriage relationship when we know that my first responsibility is to move with humility toward my spouse when I'm in disagreement. Right? But what happens if I move with humility toward my wife when we're in disagreement? Now I'm vulnerable, right? I apologize, and what's she going to say? Darn right. Duh, that's not what I wanted to hear. I wanted to hear you say, yeah, well, it's really my fault or something like that. Right? Am I right? I think I'm right. What are we really saying? We're saying that going God's way is a risky proposition. We are not in a fundamental way trusting God. Well, we'll unpack some of that more next week as well. There is in this suspicion, this movement from trust to suspicion of God, a catastrophic cost involved in our ingratitude, because that's really what's at stake here. Rather than just being grateful for the good things that God gives, we feel that we must have things we want on our terms, our way. And that ingratitude in the heart of humanity actually completely colors the way that we are able to view God and everything else. Paul puts it this way in Romans 1. He says, what's known about God is evident within them, for God has made it evident to them. We talked about the uniqueness of humanity a couple of weeks ago. And these things about who God has made us that we recognize within ourselves could never be the product of time plus chance, a bag of chemicals. We're free, we have personality, we have all manner of things that cannot be produced by nature. And we know, everyone knows that. God has made it evident within us. Since the creation of the world, God's invisible attributes, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen through what has been made so that they are without excuse. Everyone knows in their honest moments that there is a God. But it goes on and he says, even though they knew God, they didn't honor him as God or give thanks. The consequence, they became futile in their speculations and their foolish heart was darkened. Wow. Wow. So when we have this thing in our heart, this attitude that is moved towards suspicion about God, gratitude for who God is and the amazing generosity of God in our life, goes out the window, and we begin thinking through the lens of that suspicion, and all of a sudden, pretty much the whole idea, the whole project of the God question is on the back burner. We have such suspicion of him that we think he no longer exists for us. That's the way it works. It's fascinating how that works. I want to talk today about whack-a-mole doubt. You know the game whack-a-mole, right? Where you get the mallet and you're pounding these little these moles as they pop up. As soon as you pound one down, another one pops up, right? You with me? Okay, this is the way it works. In the ungrateful heart of fallen man, we cannot think objectively about the God question. And so we're thinking from that bottom line, that suspicion, that the thought that whatever it is that God's into is not what I want to be into, is not my thing. And so that separation between ourselves and God is filled and is more or less intellectualized with an endless battery of questions. And as soon as one question pops up and get addressed, boom, another question pops up and you just keep going. How long? Sadly, for the rest of your life. Over the weekend, I had a couple of conversations with friends. One who's been a Christian for many years. Another who is investigating and really thinking through Christianity. Both of them are whack-a-mole doubters. The one who is a believer has come to a place in his life where he's being called upon God to make risky, difficult decisions, to go beyond what's comfortable for him, to trust God, and to move toward the real needs of the people around him. And he's just overwhelmed with the sense of inadequacy. He's introverted. He's got these things going on in his life. And the longer he has sat in this place, this uncomfortable place, knowing what God's calling on him to do and resisting that, not wanting to take this step of faith because he suspects that God ultimately isn't there for him, doesn't have his best interest in mind, manifests itself then in an endless chain of questions. Does God really exist? Is the God of the Old Testament the same as the God of the New Testament? I don't know what happened at the cross. All these things, I'm like, brother, you've been a Christian for 25 years. Surely you've understood these things. Yeah, well, not anymore. I've lost that. Why? Because there are questions beneath the questions. That's why. And they are coming out of a heart that is resistant to the things of God because we are suspicious of him. We all have that element working against us. It's pretty profound. Let's move on, though. There's a second dimension here of the temptation and fall that we find within ourselves, and that is the promise of autonomy. The autonomous self, the devil says to the woman, your eyes will be opened and you will be like God. Well, that sounds pretty good. Yeah. I answer to nobody? Far out. That's great. It's all about my pride. It's all about me. Right? I'm the standard now. No longer do I determine what's right or wrong, good or bad, by the will of God as it's expressed to me. I set that aside and I say, I'm the standard now. I'm the one. I choose what's good for me, what's not good for me. What's true, what's not true. I am the master of my castle, the lord of my domain. I am the only person I answer to. I'm the standard. Democritus in the 5th century BC, a Greek philosopher put it like that. He said, man is the measure of all things. Who do we look to? We look to ourselves. We define what's right and wrong. We define what is beautiful and ugly. We define what's just or unjust. We're the ones. We don't look outside ourselves. We have taken in and arrogated to ourselves the right to determine these things for ourselves. That's what we're talking about. There are implications to this. The bottom line is that God, here again the suspicion, is a threat to my freedom. That freedom has to be expressed as self-assertion rather than the freedom to actually subordinate myself to the care of a God in whose image I made, who's made me with a certain kind of design, who knows how that works better than I do, and to respond in simple trust in that. No, we think in our world that freedom means I go my own way, I chart my own course, don't we? Well, we're going to come back to that in a minute. We're like a veritable race of gods, each in their own little universe. Thirdly, is it a desire or a design that drives human behavior? Let's take a look at this. The woman saw that the tree was good for food, that it was a delight to the eyes, that the tree was desirable to make one wise, so she took it and she ate it, and her husband also ate it. Notice the shift in the language. This is actually pretty important. God established this tree of the knowledge of good and evil as a context to choose to obey God or to defy Him. That's what it was, but it is a moral decision. Right? The tree of the knowledge of good and evil. So there's moral substance to that. What is occurring here in this temptation narrative is a move out of the moral and into the desirable, a delight to the eyes. It's desirable. And so what we find then is that shift in our thinking. The primary problem with me is not an ethical problem. It's not that I've defied God and have brought the consequences of that defiance into my life and into the lives of those that I affect. No, we think what's wrong, the problem here, is psychological. It's a matter of my desire states. Here, desire has the very highest value. We could not be talking to a culture who understands this better, because that is exactly the kind of culture that we live in. We have taken this aspect of rebellion against God about as far as it can possibly go in our affluence, in our culture that has thrown aside any kind of constraints to behavior so that the highest value that we all serve is what's going to make me feel the things I want to feel. And so there's a real conflict between what we could call real and apparent goods. There are things that we need, and there are things that are good. And sometimes when we put what's good and make it into the best, we make it into the ultimate. That's what an idol is. And we begin to serve the good by making it the ultimate. Because why? Because it satisfies for us a certain kind of a desire. That is an idol. That is a replacement for God in our life. Boy, here's a question for you, folks. What makes for fulfillment? Does fulfilling your every desire make you fulfilled as a person? That's what we're told, right? Get ahead, commit to self, get your life in order so that you're immune from the unpleasantries of the world around you. Then you're going to be fulfilled. Except for no, we're not fulfilled. It doesn't work like that at all. Simply satisfying our desires does one thing and one thing only, which is this: to create more desires. It's whack-a-mole living. I thought I satisfied the desire, and yet there's another one, and another, and another, and another, and we begin to realize, man, I'm a slave to my own desires. We're going to come back to that one as well. The bottom line is that my desires should be satisfied in our culture, and that others must respect my desires, whatever they may be, unless they impinge upon the freedom of someone else. So consent is really the only principle that we have agreed to as a society that is committed unreservedly to the satisfaction of our desires. We do wonder, however, where does this principle of consent come from? Where is it written? Who says? It's arbitrary. Let's move on. Let's really give this some teeth. Let's think about this. How does the world work? How does a broken world work? Let's take these principles that we've looked at and build on them just a little bit. Next week, we're going to apply them to the ways in which we are broken as human beings. But today, we want to just remain in this question of what is really at the core, what is really at the heart of the problem for humanity, and it is what's wrong with us is what's wrong out there. How does the world work? John puts it this way in 1 John chapter 2, verses 15 and 16. He says, "Do not love the world, nor the things in the world. All that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the boastful pride of life is not from the Father, but from the world." The world. In the Greek, it's the word cosmos, which means the physical world, but it means more than that. The cosmos is like an ordered system. So we think of someone who is cosmopolitan as someone who's widely experienced about the world. Or cosmetics, which means that you're fixing up something that is unacceptable where it is, or whatever you think about that. Cosmos is an ordered system, animated by certain values, animated by the values of those who are in rebellion against God. The world system. What is the value system that animates our culture, that animates all human culture? John kind of puts it like this. He says, well, there's the lust of the flesh. Eve saw the fruit and was like, wow, man, that's some fruit. And so she began to desire that. There's a sensualism, sensual desire, which God created for us to satisfy and to indulge in a particular framework and context that he has for us. But in the world system, our sensual desires become the ultimate. That's what I'm doing. And we even have people telling us that you're actually hardwired for that and nothing else. That's the essence of Freudian psychoanalysis. You always think about sex. While I'm thinking about, well, that's really sex. You know, so just kind of reinterpretation of everything because that's the way we are. The lusts of the flesh, indulgence, substances. Whatever it is that stimulates those nerve endings, boy, count me in. That's what I want. The lust of the eyes. I see. I want. Like Caesar. Remember that? Vene, vici, vici. I came, I saw, and so I conquered. I want it. I see these things. I have a house, but I saw another house, and now I realize my house sucks. And what I really need in life is this other thing. And it just, there's this endless flow of a culture that is calling us to orient our thinking, our minds, to drench our thoughts with the things that we might acquire. Our whole economy is rooted in that hope. At the end of the day, John says, the boastful pride of life. What is boastful pride? It's arrogance. That's what it is. You can be like God. Who's it all about, folks? Me. I mean, for you, it's you. But for me, it's me. And so we're going to do whatever we need to do to firm up our agenda. And we're going to arrange our life in such a way that it furthers my cause, my thing. And the whole framework of life as we live it in our social construct is rooted in these values from the world. And so there are implications to that. Namely, the boastful pride of life, the one who says, I answer to no one but me. I am the integration point of my own life. It all revolves around me. Well, okay, we have the freedom to attempt to live that way at least. But what about bearing the weight of the autonomous self to be the one who is the standard of all good and right and beautiful and true? Wow. That is weighty. And there are effects that come to those of us, which is to say all of us, who have taken upon ourselves this pride of place in our own lives. For one, it means that we are almost certainly growing in our alienation from other would-be gods who are also trying to control their world. This is not new. In the early 19th century, as the American experiment was not even into its second generation, I guess, the French sociologist, really, I guess the father of sociology, Alexis de Tocqueville, took a tour through the United States. And here's what he said. He said he coined this term individualism to describe what he saw in American society. Individualism, he said, is a calm and considered feeling which disposes each citizen to isolate himself from the mass of his fellows and withdraw into the circle of family and friends. With his little society formed to his taste, he gladly leaves the greater society to look after itself. They form the habit of thinking of themselves in isolation. Why? Because I am, after all, the center of my universe. And imagine, he says, that their whole destiny is in their hands. I pick myself up by my bootstraps. I rely on no one but me. Each man, he says, in consequence, is forever thrown back on themselves alone, and there is danger that he may be shut up in the solitude of his own heart. What a profound observation that was nearly 200 years ago now. We are a desperately alienated, desperately lonely culture. Why? Because we have the resources to live out the core values of the world system, and we are paying a profound price in our own soul because we have embraced this lie. Robert Bella, sociologist from Berkeley, has said it like this in his book, Habits of the Heart. It's an important book. You should read it. He says, values turn out to be incomprehensible, rationally indefensible thing that the individual chooses when he or she has thrown off the last vestige of external influence and has reached pure, contentless freedom. Like, I just want to be able to do my thing my way. That's the bottom line. and what gives justification for this way of living as opposed to something else, simply the matter that I choose it. That's the only real reason for that. And so we've got a whole society of 400 million would-be gods trying to control their own little universes, and we are utterly spinning outside of one another's orbits and into one another. Can we bear the weight of our autonomous self, or self cut off from our Creator, left on our own to make the call? What about the future of love? There's an implication here as well. Alan Bloom, in the 1980s, late early 90s maybe, wrote a book called The Closing of the American Mind, and he put it like this. He says, there's a quest, but ever more hopeless, for arrangements of ways of putting the broken pieces back together. He's talking about relationships in our culture. He says, the task is equivalent to the squaring of the circle, which, think about that, it's not possible, right? You can't make a square circle. Think about that. Close your eyes. A square circle. Can't be done. Either it's a square or it's a circle. The task of relationships in our culture is like trying to make a square circle. Why? Because everyone loves himself most. Think about that. But then wants others to love him more than they love themselves. That's a problem, my friends. Who's gonna give to the Godhead that is the other person? Well, we say, we'll just work out a negotiation. Oh yeah, that's great until that negotiation breaks down. Right? And then what? We got nothing. No foundation, no basis for the relationship. And so this is what this book is about. It's about the growing alienation in the American family. It's pretty profound. Here's what we need to think about, and this is really kind of our last point. Real evil and a fallen humanity. That's what we're presented with in Genesis chapter 3. And I want us to just kind of really reflect on this for a minute together. Andrew Del Banco is a professor of American literature at, what's that university in Manhattan? Columbia, thank you. I've discovered that old age brings the forgetting of proper nouns. Anyway, he did a study of American literature on this question of evil and then wrote a book called The Death of Satan. And in it, he says, he explains, the driving motive in writing this book has been the conviction that if evil with all its insidious complexity escapes the reach of our imagination, it will have established dominion over us. He asks, on what basis can we justify outrage? You know, there are terrible things that happen in this world, terrible things that happen in our society, terrible things that happen in our families and our own lives. What does it mean when we say it's terrible? What does it mean when we say that something is evil, is wrong? What is the substance or content of that universal human assessment? And what Del Banco is saying is that we have lost the ability to really even conceptualize evil because we have drifted from a biblical view of morality. This as an agnostic, he's not a Christian, not a believer in God. He's making a pure analysis of our culture. Let's think about this. He says that evil is a notion that escapes the reach of our imagination. We can't even define what this thing is. What is evil? And what is the embodiment of evil? Maybe it's this. You're giggling. You're chuckling because why? Because it's such a passé and bizarre and irrelevant understanding of something as profound as evil. The devil, really? Or this early American wood carving of the Satan followers breathing deep the flatulence of the devil. And yeah, that is exactly what that is. And you laugh some more, because this too seems completely absurd. What? You know, 95% of people in our culture believe in God. Are you aware of that? Fewer than half, by far, believe in the existence of a personal evil being of Satan. Can you blame them? How do we conceive of real evil? How about that? Oh yeah, that's where we started our discussion tonight, isn't it? What is that? That's Jackson Pollock. It's his painting called Lucifer. What does it mean? Nobody knows. His art style is called abstract expressionism. He's not even trying to communicate something that you can get your mind around or understand or use as a framework to make sense out of a broken and corrupt world. This is what he's left with. My friends, if we deviate from the biblical view, the biblical teaching that there is real personal evil embodied both by God's adversary, the devil, and embodied in ourselves as sons and daughters of Adam and Eve, we're left with Jackson Pollock. We're left with no ability to conceptualize the evils that confront us in life. And therefore are left with no real tools to deal with them. And that is a tragic, tragic reality in any life or in any society. That's why Del Banco concludes. He says, I believe that our culture is now in crisis because evil remains an inescapable experience for all of us while we no longer have a language for describing it. We just, either things suck or they don't. And that's basically all we have, is how I feel about something, but that doesn't bring content to the thing. It doesn't enable us to say, here is the problem. And understanding that problem, being able to then move toward the solution. And that is the whole story of the Bible. It's moving toward that solution. And so we say in our society, we just dropped the whole category of evil altogether. We think of evil as a mistake. As Shakespeare put it, to err is human, right? Or, as Benjamin Franklin is described, this again from Del Banco's book, it's pretty interesting. He said, Benjamin Franklin eliminated entirely from his autobiography the word sin. And borrowing a term from the print shop, substituted erratum, you know, errors, misprints, whenever he spoke of his betrayals or other actions he wished to excuse from the record, public record of his life. We don't even capture that sense that there's something fundamentally wrong with me. It's just that I've made a calculational error that any finite being would do, right? And that sort of is the narrative that is our society. And so Del Banco asks us to consider the man in the mirror. He said, this is really worth kind of thinking about here tonight. The crusader who construes evil as a malignant external thing, that is to say, a thing alien from himself, is by far the worst kind of barbarian. What is he saying? He's saying, let me tell you what's really wrong with the world. It's me. I'm what's wrong with the world. And you share in that same thing. The problem's not out there. Well, it is out there. There are real problems out there. I don't want to minimize that for a minute. But those are symptomatic of the deeper thing, the thing that is within. And to just keep our focus on, if we could just create economic equality and do all these things that we think might make things better, that somehow will be different kinds of people, not so. And the Bible declares in one breath, both on the one hand, the incredible dignity of man, as we've been talking about, man in the image of God, full of unimaginable value, eternally significant in the eyes of God, and yet so broken by our rebellion against him that the worst thing that we can say about the world is what's true of ourselves as individuals. A definition of evil that excludes yourself, Delbanco is saying, is by far the worst kind of barbarianism. Yeah. How you feeling? Cheerful. Paul says it like this in Romans 3, verse 23. He says, hey, all have sinned and fallen short of God's glorious standards. We're all guilty. We all are ones who hold God with suspicion. We've moved from trust to suspicion. We all are ones who have arrogated to ourselves the right to be the God of our own life. Right? All of us have found the thing that drives us are our desires, whether that's to inflate our languishing ego or to experience pleasures or to acquire things or whatever it is. And that is us. And that is what is leading to our own destruction. That is the narrative that informs human history. The dignity of man to do incredible things and the Achilles heel of his own moral corruption. All have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. And so, my friends, next week we'll have some good news for you. But the good news is meaningless until we have really embraced the bad news. Any solution to the human dilemma that does not fully understand the depths of the problem will be a superficial solution. And so there it is. And next week we're going to come back and we're going to talk about how the broken heart of humanity affects us existentially. And then we're going to talk about how Genesis 3 is the seed of the most remarkable story imaginable. We're going to work that story out next time.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.